You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sometimes in football, you have to hold your hand up and say, yeah, they're better than us. Those are the old words of Sir Alex Ferguson. But this is also a man who openly admitted time after time, I don't like losing, and said, I tell the players that the bus is moving. This club has to progress and the bus wouldn't wait for them. I tell them to get on board. The greatest football manager of his era, Fergie is remembered for the victories, an insatiable desire to win, a commitment to glory so thorough and disciplined that he saw off rivals in all shapes, sizes and forms over more than two decades. But what about the defeats? Because there were many of them, 271 to be precise. Well, Ferguson himself has said the following: losing is a powerful management tool so long as it does not become a habit, and you learn more from defeats than you do from victories. In a new book titled Even the Defeats, journalist John Silk tells the story of how the painful moments of Sir Alex Ferguson's reign at Manchester United inspired him to lead the club to its greatest successes, beginning with a 5-1 loss at Manchester City and ending with the final Premier League title. The book looks at what was perhaps Ferguson's greatest strength, dealing and overcoming adversity, with views from players, coaches and other members of staff. Even the defeat is out already, and I'm pleased to be joined by the author John Silk to talk about Ferguson, those defeats and the book in general. John is a journalist working for Deutsche Welle. He's covered sports and international affairs for more than a decade and has followed United for 40 years. John, thank you for coming on the Manchester United Weekly Podcast. It's an exciting new topic for a book.
Yeah, it is. It's one I've been considering, and it's been there at the back of my mind for a long time. It kind of came to the forefront of my mind probably in the last couple of years when I started really seriously considering the book. And the more I thought about it, the more I could see a relationship between, you know, some of the best moments as being a United fan during the Ferguson era. Every time I found the top moment, whether it be 99, whether it be 2008, whether it be some of the great Premier League titles and possibly none more so than his last one in 2013, Every time I looked at it and analysed it, I could see a relationship and a serious lineage, a serious line between, you know, a bad moment, if you like, a setback, adversity. And you mentioned that in your intro that Ferguson was never better than in adversity, and he pretty much says so himself on many occasions.
Yeah, and I thought I'd dive straight in there to begin with and ask you what you think the greatest of all the setbacks was. And I think as fans we can kind of remember maybe the biggest scorelines of defeat, and the 6-1 was the last massive one of those against City. But I think sometimes the setbacks are kind of in fact the periods rather than one certain match. In fact, the periods of struggle that maybe fans remember less conveniently and less immediately. But writing the book, what did you come away with thinking this was the moment where Ferguson was at his best, where he came from the lowest ebb and to the highest peak?
I think probably when you frame the question like that, I think probably would be the sort of 04, 05 period, 06. The years when there were other years when we just missed out on the title. 95 obviously is obvious, 92 to some extent, 98, you know, but they were probably very explicable and you could cite particular reasons. I think for both fans to some extent, and maybe even Ferguson himself, or certainly the way he recovered, because it was such a stretch. It was such a period and losing at Benfica in 05, I think it was December, where I think there were many fans and certainly pundits who thought, you know, that was the end and it was going to be a sad end in a way. And it was going to be an end possibly like Wenger kind of experienced a decade later. And I think we all feared that. We'd still remember him as being one of the best, if not the best managers in United's history, even if he'd gone out on a slightly lower ebb in sort of 06, 07, if he hadn't quite managed to drag the club from that period. But I think the reason why for Ferguson it's also particularly impressive is just because, you know, I think he was looking at the longer game. There were other things going off the pitch, but let's talk about on the pitch. You know, his investment in players like Rooney and Ronaldo and the way he did learn from Wenger, from Mourinho, I think it's a really underrated strength that Ferguson would not be too proud all the time to not learn from others. And I think that would be the period and that would be the setback, I would say, used because it's over a period of time other than just one individual defeat that probably gives him and even fans a lot of pride and joy. If there's one setback, though, that probably hurt him the most, I'm going to have to say two. I think the time losing the league in the manner in which they did in 2012, losing that, you know, devastated him. And, you know, knocked the wind out of him to some extent and even his family. I mean, he talks about his wife not wanting to, or, you know, his wife says she didn't even want to go out because she was too afraid of meeting City fans. And I spoke to Paul Heywood at length about this and how devastated Ferguson was about it. However, he recovered from it and he responded a year later. And Paul Heywood also spoke about how, you know, his response to that was magnificent. And Ferguson told Paul Heywood about the level of hurt that gave him, also strengthened his resolve. The amount of time he'd spend analysing opponents, the amount of time he'd spend in the video analysis room was driven and partly down to the manner of the defeat from the year before. But there's probably a defeat or two, possibly, you could say, that he didn't recover from. And therefore, I think retrospectively, in the 6 years or 7 years since he retired, that I think 2009, Champions League final, and that's obviously something I talk about as a fan in the book, just because he never quite got the legacy in Europe, the United era that he so yearned for.
I think for me, that's the single most painful game I can remember. It was because, and you mentioned this in the book, because there was so much confidence going into that game. European champions, 2007, we'd been close to a treble. 2008, the double. 2009, there was still the expectation that Manchester United were the world's best team. And it wasn't just the defeat and the result, but the manner in which Barcelona just dispatched of this incredible United side made the hurt so much more. And I think that's one that, whereas the Aguero moment, I think, was made up for with such a dominant 2013 title victory, I don't think 2009 was ever made up for.
No, that's the one that there was. I mean, obviously 2013 was painful too, but I do think there's a bit different with 2013, because although that hurt Ferguson immensely at the time, and that's talked about in the book, and René Meulensteen gave me a lot of insight into that defeat and how Ferguson was afterwards. I think with that defeat in 2013, there's not much really Ferguson could really have done differently. I mean, he set the team up amazingly home and away. We probably were the better team for 75, 80% of that. And of course, the sending off of Nani. And whereas 2009, there's a lot of regret, I think, with that. And going into the final as favourites. And you win that match and suddenly Ferguson can retire knowing that we had what he always wanted, which was a United era of, if not dominance, you would certainly call it the United era, given, as you highlighted, 2007 being so close, winning it in 08, winning it in 09, you know, you've got a nice body of work there that, you know, for 3-4 years, you know, we got to the final again in 2011, but we were a long way off Barcelona by then. That's the one, really. And we could have and should have done better. I talk about it in the book, and I think Kiros's absence on the training pitch, I speak about it a lot regarding the 2008, you know, Champions League victory. And I think his absence meant that Ferguson felt, in a way, in 2009 and then also in 2011, there was no other way that Ferguson felt comfortable setting up a team. So he wanted to be open. And I know we played three in midfield, but there's so many different ways you can play, you know, three in midfield, that this we were still very aggressive, I think, in terms of the first 15 minutes. It was going behind that killed us that night. And Ferguson has a lot of regrets about that game.
Yeah, you mentioned Kiros, and I think that for all of us, that there's a, for some people, it's kind of a willing acceptance, and for others, it's kind of a reluctant acceptance that he was so crucial to 2008. And I'd be interested to hear more about the journey from the AC Milan semi-final defeat in 2007 to Moscow in a second. But you've spoken to, you mentioned René Molenstein and many others, journalists, coaches, ex-players. And it clearly changed over time and depended on the scenario. But can you attempt to summarise the default standard response of Sir Alex Ferguson to a setback, to defeat? And I think from my perspective, having not studied it in the detail that you have, it seems kind of to be broken down into the convincing the fans to carry on trusting him, whether that's through the media or a change in performances, and then the internal kind of diplomacy in the dressing room. But I mean, you go ahead with your knowledge.
Sure. I mean, René Molenstein spoke about that, and we'll talk about it in three phases. There would be the sort of the first phase in terms of the dressing room, how he reacted. And sometimes he'd be unpredictable in the dressing room, and the players, kind of, I mean, Ferdinand also spoke about that level of unpredictability on occasion. I think he liked that sometimes that they would expect to get a bollocking and they would get the arm around the shoulder. But in general, Ferguson's reaction to a defeat would just be, did they let themselves down? You know, I think in 2009, for example, he did think he let themselves, you know, they let themselves down. Michael Carrick has spoken about that on more than one occasion. So there'd be that reaction in the dressing room. Now, that may also be at halftime, by the way. And Ferguson was a master at getting his message across, being angry with players, for example, and yet still motivating them. We know that some people don't take well to criticism. But, you know, Ferguson could also do it in a very clever way. He could say, you're better than that, you know, which is an excellent phrase to use with a player who's being chastised. And yet he's going, wow, you know, he thinks I'm a good player. And he's going to go out and perform better in the second half, for example, or the following week. There's also that bit that you spoke about with the media. And I think when it came to the media, Paul Heywood speaks about it and how he would, you know, get himself ready for the media. And this could be on the Friday before the match, and this could also have followed a defeat a few days before. And Ferguson would go on the attack and he'd be ready for it. And he'd want to get a message across. You know, Clive Tilsley told me that once he interviewed him after a Manchester Derby defeat in 2002, and Ferguson was raging about the players, basically, and how he wanted to let the fans in to let them know what it meant to lose a derby. And Clive Tilsley joked that he could have asked him what the capital of Ecuador was that day, and Ferguson still would have responded the same way. So I think Ferguson knew what he was doing, and there was often a message in this time that he wanted to get the fans on board too. And it didn't matter how he would do that. And we did. We were all singing from the same hymn sheet. And I think that's where Ferguson, the leader, comes in. And even the media and even opposition were singing from the same hymn sheet, if you like, that they would believe that we were better in second halves of seasons, even though if we really closely scrutinize some of the statistics, particularly in the 90s when this narrative emerged, actually a different pattern emerges. But it doesn't matter if people are on board. And this is kind of almost a politician, a leader, getting everyone on board, whether that be, you know, fans, players, backroom staff, or even opposition people, if you like. So then there would be a third phase, which René Molenstein also speaks about as well, where, and this was a nice touch that Molenstein would really appreciate, where, you know, he'd go into the, you know, opposition dressing room, shake hands after losing against Porto, I think it was in 2004, sharing a bottle of wine with an opposing manager, with the exception, of course, of Wenger, as we all know. And this would be the third phase that that Rene speaks about at length in both the forward, but also in the book as a whole. And I found it fascinating. And I think we all did, didn't we? I mean, listen, when we lost 6-1 to Man City, I was devastated by the result, of course, in 2011. But I also wanted to know what Ferguson had to say. I was desperate. And I was desperate to know what to say after other defeats and other setbacks. And I was desperate to know, but I was also on board. You know, I would be motivated as a fan. And that was the stranglehold he had over everyone, really, at the time.
Yeah, it seems different to now, when I think over the last few managers, after a defeat like that, you hear them, you're looking for the mistake in what they say to kind of justify your frustration at a result. Whereas with Ferguson, I think you look to what he said for kind of guidance, for comfort, to know what to think about the game. And I don't know, I think that there's not many managers who have replicated that control over a fan base.
Yeah, right. I mean, I completely agree with Ferguson, of course, for the last 20 years, pretty much, with the odd exception, he had success to back him up. So I guess that helps. But he galvanized everyone and the fans as well. We just, you know, we loved it. We loved when he talked about noisy neighbors, or we loved it. And we were on board with that. We loved it as well, even in defeat, when we had a crushing defeat against, you know, or not being knocked out by Bayern in 2010. And he came on TV and he said, typical Germans, even though, like, you know, 7 of the 8 players surrounding the referee were not German. We didn't scrutinize it. We just loved it. We it was great that he felt like we did, and he was as upset as we were. So, I mean, when you talk about the modern day and the reaction to defeat, one of the ones that sticks out for me since 2013 and the reaction to it was Mourinho's reaction to the not when we were knocked out by Seville in 2018. I think it was February, March time. That for me, I was. You know, I was still wanting to win titles, of course, and you always do. But that reaction that Mourinho showed, and he talked about heritage, and what he meant by that was United's, you know, lack of success in Europe in recent years. Well, that was not what we wanted to hear. We wanted to hear that losing to Seville, because, by the way, you know, that's fair enough to say that under Ferguson in 2013, we went out, you know, in the knockout stage, the year before as well in the group stage. But generally, if we went out under Ferguson in the latter years, with the exception of that group stage knockout, we went out in 2007, okay, to Milan. That's fine, semi-finals. We lost to Barcelona in 2009, 2011. You know, that's fine. You know, it's not great. We don't like it. We're upset about it. And we know the hurt, but we're not, you know, we know that the manager has done what he can. 2010, yeah. Bayern. This is a completely different situation. Real Madrid, 2013. That's completely different to going out to Seville. You know, with all due respect. And Mourinho's reaction to that was, well, I think that he lost the fans, really, from that moment onwards. I mean, some might say he never had them on board, but at that stage, he was gone for me.
Yeah. I'd be interested to take a small part of the book and get an insight into that particular section. And I think for me, I'd be interested to hear how United got to, as you put it in the book, Red Square Delight in Moscow in 2008. And it's an interesting one, because I spoke to Clive Tilsley and Daniel Harris for a couple of episodes back in April, looking back at the 7-1 against Roma and then the games against AC Milan in the semi-final. And the mistakes made that saw United lose to AC Milan in that semi-final were so efficiently corrected the next year that it's kind of that seems obvious, but there was obviously so much more before the defeat to AC Milan that allowed United to make just little tweaks in terms of resting players in the midweek games in the Premier, not midweek, in the weekend games in the Premier League, to make sure United got through to the 2008 final. All that foundational work from 2001-2. Can you kind of describe that as it's in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think Ferguson was so desperate by then to win a Champions League somehow or another. that, as you mentioned, the difference between Milan, for example, in 2007 and then winning in 08. I mean, I remember between the two Barcelona games, we played a huge game against Chelsea and he rested three or four, five big players, actually, I think. Unfortunately, Rooney still got injured, I think, in that Chelsea match in between the two legs. But whatever, you could just tell that's how much it meant and how Ferguson talks about going out to Milan. And there's disappointment and regret, of course. But he also recognises that the conditioning of the squad, I think the squad was a little thin that season. We'd probably got away with it a bit domestically until that, you know, period of the season. And we had a good enough cushion in the league that it didn't matter so much. But we did get found out against Milan to some extent, but our defence was ravaged with injuries. And I don't think he wanted to have the same injury situation again a year later, no matter what. Which is interesting because when it gets to that final in 2008, that was the 11 that I think all fans and Ferguson knew was the 11 that he wanted to put out. He wanted that when we got Hargreaves the summer before and we also got Tevez, they were first team starters really that he aimed to have in the team. Nani and Anderson were bought with a bit more long term and were going to be squad players. And do you know how many times that 2018 played together as a starting 11?
I'm going to assume it was none before that.
It was none before and it's been none since. So once. And it was like a crescendo, if you like. And that was the 11 that there's no more evidence than to say that we went into that final. I think Saha was the only player that was unavailable through injury. I thought Gary Neville as well. But whatever. I mean, that was the 11 that he wanted. And he got them to the peak at the right time, if you like. And that was really, Ferguson would often talk about peaks. I think that journey, of course, though, I mean, you mentioned sort of 01, 02. The journey really begins in 2000. Unlike the 93 to 99 journey, which was generally upward, the 2000 to 2008 journey is kind of downward from 99, if you like, until it gets to a rock bottom period, losing to Benfica in the group stage when we went out, to then sharply going back up again towards winning it in 2008 and kind of still staying at the top even by 2009. And the 2000 evolution to 2008 is interesting. So many people have covered this, but it's kind of clear with the way that we went out in 2000 to Madrid that we were too cavalier, and the idea of winning the Champions League like we'd won it in 99 was very quickly abandoned between 2000 and 2002. The Veron basically purchase wasn't a defensive purchase. Veron was not a defensive player, far from it, you know. But it did mean having three bodies in the centre of midfield. That was the idea, at least. Unfortunately, Veron's tactical discipline and I think also Keane's intimidation meant the whole experiment just didn't work and effectively, in a way, blew up in Ferguson's face to some extent. Mm. But it just meant and there was a gradual decline until that Benfica result in 05. Now, of course, also in this period, which is crucial, two things, if you like, or three, arguably, if you throw Rooney in as well, his evolution. But it's the Ronaldo effect, if you like, that when he came in 2004 and Carlos Queiroz, that when Ronaldo was signed, it was 2003 Ronaldo was signed, same summer that Beckham went. And this is something that I haven't seen talked about at all by anyone. But I remember when we won the league on the penultimate sort of weekend of the season, and Ferguson was interviewed on TV and he was asked about, you know, the winning the league. And all he wanted to talk about really, or certainly the thing that struck for me was he wanted to talk about going out in the Champions League that year in the quarterfinal to Real Madrid as well, in sort of Beckham's sort of last hurrah, if you like. He came off the bench and all the rest of it. We kind of know that result and Ronaldo, the Brazilian Ronaldo's hat trick. But what he spoke about, interesting, which I've never seen anyone talk about, you know, before or since, sorry, and I mentioned the book, is he spoke about how he was kind of talking about how Madrid had players that could beat another player, could go past another player, and suddenly you're a man up. So the idea that he felt that Beckham could possibly do that was obviously not the case, although he didn't mention him, of course, by name. But he did think that Ronaldo could do that. And of course, he didn't mention him by name because this is May 2003. This is a couple of months before, you know, that in and out happens. But that was crucial. And he felt that players like Figo, even Zidane, in the way he'd bring the ball down, could take two players out in one touch. Figo, the Brazilian Ronaldo, Raul to some extent, the Madrid striker, all of these players could go past people and beat them. And suddenly, when you are counter-attacking, for example, this is crucial. We all remember how Redondo basically left John O'Shea, was it, behind down the wing, and John O'Shea was basically in a different time zone by the time, you know, Redondo was at the touchline pulling it back for Raul to tap in. So that was an interesting thing that as well. And then of course Carlos Queiroz also comes in around the same sort of time, and Queiroz's importance and Rene Meulensteen to some extent in you know, Cristiano Ronaldo's development and the evolution of the side. I mean, United fans, we don't really talk about it much, but, you know, if we analyze the Barcelona home and away, for example, or away and then at home in the semi-final in 08, that was a very different, you know, evolution of United to the one in 99 that steamrolled and would go home and away and attack Barcelona or Bayern or whoever. So that's kind of it. And then, you know, we make it to the final. We're in peak condition. Thankfully, we won that final. I also talk about the penalty shootout. There's a funny moment, if you really listen closely, that we win the toss and Ferdinand shouts across to the team or the management, and he's kind of unsure if we want to take first or not. And Queiroz did kind of have that planned out. He wanted Ronaldo to take the third one. So, the level of planning and Ferguson had changed a bit as well. And that was something that Ferguson could do. We all know about his evolution, but he could embrace, I think with every assistant, and I don't want to down previous assistants too much, but I think with every assistant, Ferguson took a step forward. And that could be, whether that be from Knox did a great job and was very useful at the time for Ferguson, and especially as a friend, as much as a coach, I guess. But then to Brian Kidd was another step forward. You know, he knew how to develop players, young players especially. Then from Kidd to McLaren again with the analysis that he could give, video analysis, sports science, and that what he could give. And then to Queiroz as well. In fact, Queiroz gets mentioned 25 times, I think, in Ferguson's second autobiography, which is the same number of times that all his previous coaches are mentioned put together, and including Mike Phelan as well, who succeeded Queiroz. And Patrice Evra also speaks about post-Queiroz that they weren't really as effective, especially in Europe, especially tactically, that Evra kind of says under his breath, if you like, but it was crucial. And then it was also crucial in, and of course, Ronaldo leaving and Ronaldo, once Ronaldo went, we never really were a threat on the European game again.
Yeah. It's so fascinating because, for such a great manager a manager who'd already received the knighthood by this time, it's the acceptance even in 2007 that there was still lessons to be learned. And I think that's a kind of a lesson for wider life, but also perhaps for current managers in the game. And this is the thing I want to finish on is, looking at Manchester United now and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, a student of Sir Alex, what can he learn from the attitude of Sir Alex Ferguson to setbacks and his willingness, not so much at the start, but at the end, to delegate those responsibilities and delegate to people who knew better than he did in Carlos Queiroz and Rene Meulensteen?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of differences before I sort of fully answer the question, though. Solskjaer, of course, is much, much, much younger. When he kind of took over, and also, you know, where he is now to where, you know, Ferguson was in his 70s when he retired, for example. And when he took over was in his 50s. Very different to Solskjaer. So talking about delegation, you know, one of the reasons for that was also Ferguson's age. You know, I think he loved being around younger players and all that, and he spoke about it a lot. But he also, you know, was more than happy to take a back seat and let certain other people come in and do that. Solskjaer's a bit more of his own man, I would say, compared to the Ferguson at the end, if you like, who would delegate. I think Ferguson, Solskjaer, of course, wants to be hands-on on everything. whereas Ferguson would take a back seat, if you like, to some certain, you know, certainly coaching sessions, for example. Where I think Solskjaer as well is at a slight disadvantage, if you like, or a big disadvantage compared to Ferguson, but also with other managers around at Rome, where Guardiola and Klopp as well, is that upon arrival, Ferguson was already established as one of the top coaches, managers, whatever you want to call it, in Britain at the time, to some extent, yeah, to a lesser extent, Europe. So when Ferguson arrives, he's already got a huge body. He's got 10 years of really good stuff at Aberdeen, or a bit less than that. So, and same, you know, Guardiola and Klopp have 10 years of top success. So when they come in, it's like this. Solskjaer doesn't have that, and he doesn't have that background. So when we analyze Solskjaer, we're also thinking, well, hasn't, you know, won a Premier League or a Champions League or a Bundesliga or whatever. He hasn't had a period of success. So, you know, the non-Man United fans, let's call it, at least, are certainly going to question him a bit quicker as a result. Yeah. Where Solskjaer could learn, I suppose, would be, you know, and I think he has got his own style of management. I do think, in terms of the way we set up, is different to Guardiola and Klopp. You know, we do press, we do try and play out from the back, but we are a little bit more on the counter-attacking side. I do think that has made us a bit one-dimensional, if you like, when it comes to teams that we need to break down. And I think that was the idea behind Fernandes and, to some extent, Van der Beek's purchases. Where could he learn specifically? Well, I think he has learned a bit, because I think at first, that first 6 to 12 months, you know, was good for the first 3 months, but then less so for the next three. And we were thinking, well, we do want someone a bit different to Ferguson. And I think he has moved on a bit, and he doesn't kind of talk as often about Ferguson, how it was in the past. I think it's the right thing to do. But I think, you know, this more than one way to skin a cat. And I think Ferguson certainly had that in his locker, whether it be tactically or whether it be off the pitch or whatever. So I guess that's the thing that I would like to see, that there's different options we would have on the pitch, really, because I think that would be the best thing that he could possibly do, and find different styles of play, and maybe you know, maybe even get, you know, someone else. But the problem that Solskjaer has is, we both know that it's a lot more than just the coach. We need two or three other people at the club that kind of know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we don't know. I mean, it's obvious. We know what Woodward's strengths and weaknesses are. And, he's displayed his weaknesses very clearly over the last 7 years. And we need him to take on a different role. But the problem is removing him from that role. And then, of course, who needs to remove him from that role? Well, the owners. And it's just... I mean, it's so obvious. It's, I mean, you and I could sit down and look at, you know, 20 decisions that the club have made since Ferguson left, and probably 17 of them would have been wrong, 18. And what makes it worse is probably we knew that at the time.
Yeah.
You know? So it's not us being clever after the event.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because I have often thought with Solskjaer that there's been a number of times where it seemed appropriate for him to bring in someone to help in a specific capacity, such as in the defence at some points over the last 2 years. You think he could do with someone like Carlos Queiroz to handle the tactics of his defence. But there's a nice bit right at the start of the book from René Mullenstein talking about Ferguson showing him a flip book just after he'd been brought into United. And there are four words that are written down in terms of the attacking side of things: pace, power, penetration, and unpredictability. And I think that it's really hard to define the mythical United DNA, because I've always thought it doesn't really necessarily exist, especially, I mean, you talked earlier about the defensive performance away to Barca in 2008. It doesn't really exist, but if it does, I think those four words that Mullenstein says in your book probably define it.
Yeah, I mean, that when he said that to me, and also, you know, obviously within the book itself, I'm kind of quite excited by that. And I think, but you know, he wanted that to be instilled in the players. And to be honest with you, Van Persie was very aware of this idea. And Muhlenstein's, you know, away from the training pitch or slightly away from on the sidelines, if you like, the talks that they would have together. I mean, Muhlenstein has the most obvious picture in Muhlenstein's kind of office, if you like, where, you know, his house in the UK. I mean, he's also working in Australia as well at the moment, but is a picture of him and Van Persie with the Premier League trophy. That's the one that really takes pride of place in Muhlenstein's house, so to speak. And you know, I remember him walk during the interview, for example, which was done on Zoom, but he walked over to the picture and sort of, you know, showed it to me, and I'm like, I'd already seen it, to be honest with you. It's so clear. and you can see, I was getting excited as a fan reading it, and I know the players were excited by this notion and this flip chart. And talking of Van Persie as well, I mean, there was a quote that Ferguson used after his debut away at Everton that we lost 1-0, actually. That Ferguson was quite upset with the players at the time. And again, there's a defeat here, but nowhere near, probably not even the top 50 most memorable defeats, if you like, how the season panned out. But Ferguson was angry with the players, and he said he wanted them to feed the ball in much quicker to Van Persie, because it was that moment that, you know, Van Persie would ghost. And Muhlenstein mentions, just ghost away. And of course, I know what it's like when I'm playing, and I'm not a great player, but sometimes I'm just thinking, I've got this space now, but you need to give me the ball now or it's too late. You know, and that was something that would really be impressed on Rooney to some extent, depending on his role in the team. And we know how he sort of drifted back a bit during that season, but Carrick as well. And as soon as you got the ball, keep an eye out for Van Persie, because he's going to just drift away and you've got to get it into him. We know Van Persie's first touch will be good and his second would often be bang. I would be excited as a player. And if you're a top player, you react positively to that.
Absolutely. John, thank you very much for coming on the Manchester United Weekly Podcast. Even the Defeat is out now and available to buy from all good bookshops, I imagine. Waterstones, Amazon and Pitch Publishing. Is there one specific place you'd like people to buy it from, though?
I mean, Pitch Publishing is the publishers, so that would be, of course, great if you went directly to Pitch Publishing on their website, which is pitchpublishing.co.uk, I think. And the book, obviously, Even the Defeats. So, I mean, that's great. But if you decide that you've got your discount with Amazon, for example, or you prefer to go into the shop itself, I mean, Waterstones and WH Smith have it too. So whatever your preference is, I hope you enjoy it as much as I did writing it.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thanks, mate.
Hope you enjoyed that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Manchester United Weekly Podcast. If you want more stuff like this, you can support the podcast and get extra episodes, including more episodes where we talk to authors about their books about Manchester United. You can go to our Patreon. Patreon is a website where podcast listeners can sign up to support the so-called content creators by paying a little bit of money each week and in return getting back some bonus content such as extra episodes, bonus episodes, extended interviews. Like this one, and much more, including bonus Q&As at the end of every episode of the Manchester United Weekly Podcast. You can sign up from as little as 38p a week, I believe, or a little bit more than that, and how much you pay depends how much you get back in return. If you want more information on that, or you want to sign up, go to our Twitter at UTD Weekly Pod, that's P-O-D, at UTD Weekly Pod, that's P-O-D, and you can get more information there. If you want to read more from me over the week, you can find me on Twitter at Harry Robinson 64, and if you want John's book, just look up Even the Defeat, Manchester United, and it should come up on Amazon, Waterstones, Pitt Publishing, wherever. That's all for now. Have a great week. Goodbye.
Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper?
a woo-hoo-er, a hand clapper, a high-fiver. I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.